Tomorrow, Terps and Hoosiers in Bloomington. Actually, a pretty big game in the early part of the season in the Big Ten. Indiana's undefeated. Maryland at 3-1. The Terps are 7-point underdogs. Johnny Holiday, Steve Suter on the call right here on your home for Maryland football, the Team 980. Coverage begins at 11 a.m. Steve Suter, love having Steve on the show. He joins us courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. Bet smarter, beat the books. Download the BetQL app today or visit BetQL.com. Steve Suter, for those of you who don't know, the greatest punt returner in the history of ACC football, holds every significant ACC punt return record, holds several NCAA punt returns and kick return records as well. He played for some of those early Ralph Friedgen teams, and he was sensational as a punt returner. So I want to start with this because I'm looking at Indiana, and people are excited about Indiana because Kurt Cignetti, who coached at Madison the last few years, took the job at Indiana, and they're off to an incredible offensive start, but they haven't played anybody. I mean, like, Maryland's, you know, schedule so far, we just, you know, they're the teams that they've played to get to 3-1, which include, you know, Michigan State and Virginia, Villanova and UConn. But do you see Indiana as being explosive and dangerous, or is it a result of playing nobody so far?
Yeah, Kevin, well, thanks for having me on. It's probably a little bit of both. I hate to walk down the line there, but it's very hard to evaluate Indiana based off of that schedule they've had early on. Yes, they're beating the teams and they're beating them handily, but the competition isn't that stiff. So got to take it with a grain of salt. With that being said, they are playing efficient and playing effective, and it looks like they are operating how they choose to operate, which is still a good sign. If you're playing bad teams, but you're only winning because you're just players are better and they're making mistakes, you're making mistakes, and you're getting away with it because you have better athletes, that's one thing. It doesn't look like that's the case. They're going through the reads on offense, and it seems like Curtis, the quarterback, hasn't thrown an interception yet. He's spreading the ball around to all the receivers. Various guys got double-digit catches, and the tight end's heavily involved too. So it looks like they're playing their offense the way they want to. So that in itself is a sign that they are at least an efficient and effective team on offense. And then it'll be said here when they get challenged by the Maryland defense, if in fact they are as good as their stats indicate.
Yeah, the quarterback, Curtis Rourke, is 71 of 94 in four games, thrown for over 1,000 yards. It's a 75.5% completion percentage, 8 touchdowns, no picks. I think that's really insightful that it's, you know, you believe that even though the schedule has been light, they're operating very efficiently. The guy's a big dude, too, so it looks like it'll be a challenge. Let's get to Maryland. The loss to Michigan State was hurtful. You know, there were opportunities on fourth down. I actually thought they were okay kicking the field goal with Howes from 41 yards out to extend that lead to 10 with, you know, just over 3 minutes to go or whatever it was. That should have been the game. He missed the kick. Maryland loses the game. Unfortunate, but they're pretty damn good and pretty explosive offensively. Give me a minute or two on the offense, Ty Felton and Billy Edwards Jr. in particular.
Yeah, well, actually, I agree with you on everything about Michigan State, too. And emotionally, I'm pretty good at not getting too emotional after the losses for Maryland. But that one, I still don't think I'm over it because they had
that one stung.
Yeah, they had plenty of chances. And now, if let's say they go up to Indiana and get this game, too, it's going to hurt even more that they didn't get Michigan State. But to the offense, yeah, let's do quickly with Billy Edwards. I think the guy's on fire. I love everything about what he's done so far to take over this team in the first few games. It's similar to Curtis Work, but Billy's making all the right decisions. Of all the games I've watched this year, he threw an ill-advised pass to Michigan State, got away with it, and then everything else mentally, maybe he's held the ball once or twice too long, took a sack. He's been playing great. I got to grade him at it. Even A to start the season. It's been a pleasant surprise, and I'm really happy for him. And then over to Ty Felton, you mentioned that dude's just a stud. And the best part about it and how he's getting these efficient yards and effective big plays isn't just one-dimensional. He's not just beating people deep. He's not just catching the ball over the middle, and he's not just catching screens and five-yard hitches, breaking two tackles and scoring. He's doing all three of those. So it's on every level he can beat you as a receiver. That's the most impressive part, and that's what's going to keep him hard to guard and hard to take him away for defenses, because he can beat you three different ways.
Tell me about the O-line. When we talked right before the season started, you said total mystery. It's a complete and utter, you know, five-man change, basically. Had no idea what to expect. So how has it performed through the first four games?
Yeah, I'll say it's a mixed bag. I guess I'm pleasantly surprised on the pass protection is much better than I thought it would be. And that's specifically the right side with Colton Berger at center, Alou Ba at right guard, and Alan Huron at right tackle. They've been what looks like the staple, the most sound part of the line early on. Isaac Bunyan at left guard hasn't come out. He's played mostly every snap first few games, and that's impressive because he transitioned from defensive line just last year. I think the left tackle spot is the one that's still maybe not up for debate, but not as secure. Andre Roy started, then got injured in the Virginia game, and Marcus Dumervil tried to come in and play against Villanova last week, but he got injured early, so then you had a true freshman, Fred Davis, out at DeMatha, a local kid, who played throughout second quarter to the end of the game. So he got valuable reps. He seemed effective enough. It was Villanova. So left tackle still gives me concerns, and maybe just the left side of the line in general. But let's go C-plus for the start of the season.
All right. By the way, back to Ty Felton just for a moment. He is number two in the country. In the country in receptions, he's three in reception yardage. And he is climbing draft boards. Not that we're concerned about that right now. We want this season to play out. But he looks like he's got a possibility, more than a possibility. It's a probability that he's going to be playing on Sundays next year. Let's flip it to the defensive side of the ball. Talk about, you know, what they've been what they've been offensively. There are a couple of studs defensively for them too, especially at safety. Talk about what you've seen with the defense so far through the first quarter of the season, third of the season.
Yeah, so I would say a lot of the hype was up front. The defensive line going into the season, the most talented front guys they've had in a while, maybe the deepest. Now, I'll agree it's probably the deepest up front, but early on, I just wasn't seeing the disruption that I thought I was going to see from Jordan Phillips, who was getting a lot of the publicity early on, and Tommy Besito and Quayshon Fuller. So I'd say the first couple games, I was not in the same corner as everybody else was hype-wise. I just need more disruption. You need some guys to just win one-on-ones and blow up a play when it's necessary. Now, with that being said, Tommy Akingbesito, number seven, their D-tackle/DN, he finally looks like it's clicked over the last couple of games, and he's finally realizing that he doesn't have to get blocked if he doesn't want to. He could be that dominant, and I think the momentum that he built in the Virginia game, he was all over the place. He had like eight or nine tackles as a DN, and some of them were 15 yards down the field, chasing down screens, making big plays and stop first downs. So it was impressive how he was getting it done. So that's exciting. You mentioned the guys in the secondary. Dante Trader is a staple. He's just been a solid player his whole career in Maryland. He's going to continue to do so, and he is a valuable asset back there. And then Glendon Miller.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember. I think we spoke. I thought he was an NFL guy before the season started, just based on body type and his athletic ability and his knack around the ball. When he got in last year, he was making plays every time, and it was a few snaps, right, because Bill Braid was playing majority of the snaps. But when he got in, you knew he was in the game, so that's a good sign. He's all over the place. So you got to credit Brandon Jacobs, freshman out of Florida, number six. He's a safety that looks like he's convinced the coaches enough or shown them that he can come out and play as a true freshman, and what that's allowed to do, Glendon Miller to move around. So Glendon Miller then becomes the nickel. Glendon Miller can go be the dime because they're confident that Brandon Jacobs can handle some of those safety roles. So that's bringing young kids along quickly, and he must have impressed them, and that's been a nice little piece of the puzzle in the back secondary now.
Yeah, he could. Both of them cover a lot of ground.
Yeah.
All right, so before we get to what you think will happen tomorrow and what the keys to a win over Indiana are, for those that aren't paying attention to Maryland football right now and don't know that, you know, they've had three successful years in a row, They've been in three bowl games. They've won three bowl games. They, you know, have won eight games the last 2 years. The Big Ten has changed. There's no more Big Ten East. There's no more Big Ten West. So you're not locked into Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State every year schedule-wise. Where do you put their talent level? And the way Mike's recruited, and you and I both know what's coming in next year looks really good, and hopefully beyond. But where is Maryland right now, talent-wise, in the Big Ten?
Man, good question. I'd say they're probably just under the top tier. Well, sorry, that tier has expanded since Oregon showed up and Washington has teams. So probably still in that tier B. Talent-wise, and I think the biggest gaps are still up front on both sides of the ball. It's clear they got receivers that can play on any team in the Big Ten. Their running backs could start for any team in the Big Ten. And defensively, I think their secondary always has talent that could start on multiple teams in the Big Ten. Linebackers probably picking one or two guys out, maybe not the entire depth chart. So with that being said, you got some guys that are tier one talent, and you got some guys that are around in the tier two all around. I got them in tier two still. And
who's
mainly
in tier two? If tier one is Oregon, Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan, okay? Mm-hmm. Is anybody else deserving of tier one? Is USC? Probably USC.
Yeah, probably.
Who's in tier two? Does it start with Iowa? Does it start with Wisconsin? Help me with tier
probably
two.
Probably starts with Wisconsin, and then it's probably like a revolving door, really, in how who you think is top of that tier two, and it's going to be based independently on each year and who they get from the portal, those types of things. So it's going to be hard to just always lump a second class in there. You know, off the top of my head, it's kind of hard to do. I mean, Iowa might be in there occasionally, but I don't think they're consistently in there.
Illinois might be in there right now.
Right. Illinois has been flirting around that top 25 the last couple seasons, so I agree with that. You know, Nebraska, now with the quarterback, maybe the rest of their talent gets optimized, and maybe they found their way into tier two. So,
by the way, is Rutgers improving their talent? They appear to be much improved.
I know. They're hard to tell, man. They seem like the same team every year. And
all right, well, we can do this when we have more time, but I want to get to what you said, which is, you know, talent-wise, it's up front, and that's what it's been since we've entered the Big Ten. It's always been skill position players. We're sending players to the league. They would start on almost any team in the Big Ten, maybe, you know, other than Ohio State, although we have guys that would start for Ohio State as well. Why do you think it is that we can't get bigger, stronger, more physical, more athletic in the trenches?
Yeah, I can't put my finger on that, to be honest. It's disappointing when you watch some of the games on Saturdays and some of their top linemen, whoever it is, call it the Ohio State or an Oregon, or like last year, the Penn State kid that went top 10 in the NFL, right. He was from our backyard. Yeah. It always seems like one of their best linemen are from the DMV. So
right.
I can't put the picture, you know, point my finger to why they don't stay home. Maybe it's just hard to recruit against. You go up to Michigan and they put you in the O-lineman room and you see 100 guys that have gone through the program and gone to the NFL, and maybe it's just too much to overlook. But it also, and Coach Locksley's always said that it's a 3-year development program with O-linemen, and they don't always develop. So like Andre Roy, this is his 3rd year in the program. Richard Softman, he's getting a chance to start, but it's not like he's locked down the position. They're the hardest, I will say this, and I've heard this from Coach Locksley in the past and other coaches, not just him, and I'm talking 10, 15 years ago. It's the hardest position to recruit in high school to project it into college, because most of the body types of alignment in high school aren't guys that worked out and trained. Right. They're just big and just overpowering sometimes. And then you don't know how that body is going to adapt to college with a weight program. Maybe it takes, maybe it doesn't. Some guys, you know, this might seem insensitive, but some guys stay sloppy their whole career, even into college. Their body just doesn't take the weight training, and it never turns out. And they figure out that they're not as dominant when they going up against other big linemen on the other side of the ball. So there's two things. It's hard to project it. It's hard to recruit it. And sometimes you think you're getting a guy, he doesn't turn out to be a guy.
You know, I'm trying to think. I mean, I think Duncan's in the league. There are probably two or three O-linemen that are actually in the league, I think, right now. Yeah, it seems like it's been there in the, you know, trenches, you know, against some of the corn-fed boys that they have the most issue with in this league. All right, Steve Suter joining us right now. How do they beat Indiana tomorrow?
They can't beat themselves. I don't usually jump on that bandwagon of Maryland versus Maryland. It seems, I don't want to call it corny, but kind of corny, right? But for this time, this type of game, this Indiana team hasn't shown that they're going to beat themselves through the first 4 weeks. So you're going to go out there and beat them. And you got to do that without self-inflicted wounds. And ever since I've been covering the team, Maryland, whether they're really talented or have had those really good seasons that you mentioned, they have had an Achilles heel of a third down penalty that takes a first down off the board, or a third right. down pass interference or defensive holding that extends a drive for their opponent that leads to points. They can't do that this week. This week has to be one where Indiana leads the game in penalties. I can't recall. I can probably count on one hand how many times that Maryland had less penalties than the opponent since I've been covering them. So that can't happen because you don't really know how good Indiana is. So you're going to go up there. You can't give them extra chances. You'd want to find out on a level playing field and don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Yeah, I mean, both of these teams, by the way, they are tied for third in the country in turnover margin, positive turnover margin. So they've done a good job there. But to your point, you go back to the Michigan State game. They give them an extra field goal attempt at the end of the first half. That's crucial. Hell, they got penalized on the game on the walk-off field goal. So if they had missed, they would have had a second chance. Those yep. things can't happen if you're, you know, in these games where you actually have a legit chance to win. So what's your prediction? What do they do tomorrow?
Man, I think it's a tight ball game. It's coming down to the fourth quarter. Maybe who has the ball last? I don't see Curtis, their work, making too many mistakes, given our secondary too many opportunities to get the hands on the ball. And Billy the same. He's been really good with taking care of the football. His two turnovers, the Michigan State one was a high pass to Felton. I'll give him that one. But Octavian Smith dropped the ball against Villanova last week. That's not on him. So I trust both the quarterbacks, and I think it's who's going to win the big play battle. And that's probably going to determine who wins it. And, of course, I'll say Maryland pulls it out with the positive vibes that Billy's going to have going back there and playing there because he's played well there before. I just think Maryland's on a roll, and hopefully they can punch Indiana in the mouth early, because Indiana hasn't given up any points in the first quarter to any opponent. So if they can go out and put a touchdown on the board in the first quarter, it might have Indiana rethinking how good they are.
Thanks for doing this. You're awesome. Appreciate it. Enjoy it tomorrow. Go Terps.
All right. You too, Kevin. Thanks, man.
All right, Steve Suter, everybody. Tomorrow, 12 noon kick on the team, 980. Big game tomorrow for Maryland. This really could determine, you know, what the rest of the slate looks like. You know, they've had some of these losses. Look, they're an underdog tomorrow. They were favorite against Michigan State last year, favorite, you know, against at home, well, on the road against Northwestern. They lost a game at home we didn't think they would lose after that Ohio State game, which was close, much closer than people thought. But yeah, big one tomorrow. Billy Edwards has been great. And Ty Felton, if you love, you know, the NFL draft at any time of the year, check out number 10 for the Terps. I played in Ashburn, played at Stonebridge. This guy is a stud and is going to be no worse than a night 2 pick in April. All right, up next, Denton's news, and then we will get to Washington beats Arizona if. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
Hitting the news you might have missed. It's Denton's Daily News.
All right, Denton, what do you got?
All right, how about the Nats last night? They lose to the Royals 7-4, but the bigger story, They did score, so that's a big story. But the bigger story is the end of the Patrick Corbin era. That's such like a weird thing to wrestle with, Kevin, because for about 80% of his time here, He was not exactly loved, I would say. Felt like a waste of money. But you also understand that he was crucial to that World Series run in 2019. He got a standing ovation yesterday, which I think was the appropriate response from Nationals fans. But I'm just curious as to now that he's officially, or not officially, but more than likely gone here, how do you look back at like the Patrick Corbin stuff?
Well, you look back at, you know, Game 7 and what he did, you know, coming in relief, pitching three innings of two-hit ball, three strikeouts for Max Scherzer, setting it up for Hudson to close out the Astros in a seventh and deciding game of a World Series. I mean, it's a legendary, you know, game for this city and for this franchise, and he was a big part of it, you know, during that postseason. He had a couple of big spots early in that World Series when he came in for an inning and got two strikeouts in game two or game one that they won 5-4? Game one. So that's what people are remembering. And, you know, overall, the last few years have been rough, clearly. But his first year here, you know, 14-7, had, I think, the best WAR that he had, the best ERA that he had, the best WHIP that he had here. And they won a World Series. So you remember. We're never going to forget some of the players in 2019. We're never going to forget Howie Kendrick. We're never going to forget what Juan Soto did. We're never going to forget Steven Strasburg and what was truly one of the most magical and incredible clutch performances in D.C. sports history. We're never going to forget what Rendon did. So when you win a title, when you win a world championship, and you were a big part of it in some key moments, you get kudos for that. Last couple of years have been rough, though.
That's a polite way of saying it, but I agree with that. How about Michael Parsons needing an MRI on his ankle on Thursday? He has not had the greatest start to the season in the world for the Cowboys, but you could say a lot of their defense hasn't had a great start.
Is the MRI on his ankle?
That's what reports said, but
that's what looked like he hurt. Not a knee, is it?
No, they said ankle, but they also mentioned like he had maybe been dealing with something of his neck during the broadcast. I thought I heard Kirk and Al kind of discuss that.
He came out and went. I think he came out and got checked for a concussion early in the game. Remember, he took he made a tackle, and at the end of it, it was incoming friendly fire, and he got smacked on the head on the ground. And that was where the referee came over and walked him off the field because they got the call down that Parsons looked like he may have gotten dinged up. He came back into the game after that.
Yeah, but the MRI's on his ankle.
Ankle, right. Yeah. What's he done this season? How many sacks does he have?
I don't know if he has any. I was about to say, I mean, I think, unfortunately, and this isn't meant to be a joke, but the biggest thing he's done is had this MRI. Like, he's really been missing in action, it feels like, for a large majority of the season. He has one sack and 11 tackles.
One sack and 11 tackles. By the way, DeMarcus Lawrence was on the sideline at the end of that game, too.
They're getting beat up on defense.
Look, these Thursday games, man, that was a weird game last night. All the penalties. And these Thursday games, man, are tough on these players, no doubt. All right, what else?
All right, so you, like many people, want some accountability in college football. I got an accountability story for you in college football. Penn State defensive coordinator Tom Allen is handing over the defensive helmet communications on the sideline to analyst Dan Connor, the reason being that Dan Connor's voice is more understandable.
It's rather important to be able to communicate. You know, he may be, who's the guy, the DC, Tom Allen?
Tom Allen, the former Indiana coach.
Oh, he's the former, that's right, that's the former Indiana coach. He may be the best X's and O's guy and the best play caller, but if the guy in the huddle doesn't understand what you're saying, that's a problem.
Have you heard Tom Allen speak before?
Yeah, I'm thinking that I have. Is it that bad?
So here, the quality of this is not the greatest, but here's just kind of like a snippet of Tom Allen. This is from a couple years ago when he was coach in Indiana.
Once that's over, then all we're going to focus on is Northwestern. That's it. I don't care about nothing else. Folks on Northwestern are coming to town. I want a huge, huge crowd.
You can kind of hear like that rasp in his voice. I imagine that doesn't translate.
Also, you know, in the midst of competition, sometimes, you know, you get hyped, you get excited, and it gets worse. So, good self-awareness there. I mean, I'm sure whomever was receiving it in the huddle was like, Coach, what did you say? what are we in? By the way, it hasn't mattered. Penn State's been awesome on defense. Awesome. So far. That's pretty funny. You know, it reminds me of, you know, Brian Mitchell had to call plays for Heath Shuler. They couldn't understand what Heath Shuler was saying in the huddle with his, you know, Western, you know, Carolina drawl. And not to mention, there was some thought that Heath didn't even really know what the plays were anyway. And Norv told Brian knew the playbook better than anything. Norv said, Brian, you got to help him out in the huddle, call these plays.
Oh, God, that's so bad. So I mentioned this in one of the earlier updates. Maggie Smith passes away at the age of 89.
Yeah.
Famous for Downton Abbey. I knew it was Professor McGonagall.
I didn't watch that show. My wife watches that show.
I never watched that. I was a Harry Potter guy, though, so I know it was Professor McGonagall.
Right. Was she the mother in Titanic or not?
I can check. I have never seen Titanic, but I can check.
That's a weird thing that you haven't seen Titanic.
There's a lot of movies.
No, I don't think she was. I'm thinking of somebody else. Okay. I know who she is. I see her. I recognize her. I know she's been in a lot of things, but I haven't seen a lot of the things that she's been in, I don't think.
She was really good in Harry Potter. I know that's not your alley, but she was really good in Harry Potter.
I didn't watch Harry Potter. I didn't watch Downton Abbey. My wife watches all of the British shows. All of them. Okay. Every single one of them. They're always on TV.
You seem thrilled about that.
Well, I mean, I know some of them are really good, but I've never sat down and really, you know, embraced any of these shows.
Harry Potter is about as British as I will go when it comes to television or movies. I've never seen the UK Office. I've never seen it. I guess Ted Lasso. Is Ted Lasso count as British or American?
Well, I'm not. That's not the genre I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the comedy shows. I mean, the UK version, the British version of The Office is the most brilliant two-season comedy ever. And it's the reason, you know, I'm a big American Office fan. But I didn't start watching The American Office until the pandemic. Literally, I would not watch the American version because I was too pretentious about there's no possible way it could be better than the Ricky Gervais, you know, Martin Freeman, et cetera. Have you never watched the UK Office? I mean, you're a big Office fan. You have to. And by the way, you can knock it out in one night. It's two seasons.
Right. Yeah, I've never watched it. I'm like you. I watched The American Office a little before you did, but I never watched it growing up. I watched it in probably like 2018.
I binged it during the pandemic, during those early days of the pandemic. That's the first time. And it's become my all-time favorite sitcom. And I would still say that the 2 years of the British Office, it's actually better. It's just not as drawn out. I mean, you know, the American Office was 9 seasons, and it's incredible. You know, obviously when Michael Scott leaves the show, it isn't nearly as good. Although I was kind of a Robert California guy. I thought he was great.
I like Robert California. I like James Spader.
David Spader was phenomenal in that role. But Ricky Gervais was incredible. And that show, I think people recognize that show for its brilliance, right? I mean, he and Stephen Merchant wrote that show together, and there was never anything like it, you know, the single camera, et cetera. At that point, I don't think, you know, that style of, what's the term? Mockumentary, I think is the term, right?
Yeah.
That show has been widely recognized as one of the greatest sitcoms of all time. I mean, the American Office has, but the British Office has a special place in a lot of the people that, you know, sort of write about this stuff. You should watch it. As much as you love the American Office, the BBC version's incredible.
All right, once football season's over. Speaking of, this is just something to keep an eye on in the world of college football, and this one hits a little closer to home. Liberty's game versus Appalachian State tomorrow has been canceled. So if you're looking at games in the Carolinas, Tennessee, you could be in jeopardy. Like, Stanford's playing Clemson. I've heard, like, the Clemson is getting really ravaged by some of this storm, so we might have a number of college football games canceled.
I think a lot of the rain in Florida and the Southeast will be gone, but as you get a little further west, like Nashville is where it's supposed to continue. Do the Titans play at home Sunday?
The Titans
play Monday Night Football.
Yeah, they play Monday night, so they should
be. Just Tampa plays Philly at home. Tampa had some massive flooding. Can we just talk about something for a moment? Did you watch any of the hurricane coverage last night?
I did not, because my parents have a home in Florida, and that would have been too much. They're safe, but it would have been too much.
Yeah. So I was watching the game primarily, but I was flipping, you know, to the Weather Channel, getting, you know, my fix of Cantori during a hurricane in between commercials, and then I watched it when the game was over. I understand that there was massive, massive storm surge damage, you know, and flooding damage. But I was curious if anybody else picked up on this. So it was a Category 4, 140-mile-per-hour winds. You know, it went from basically a Category 1 to a Category 4 in like 4 hours during the course of a day. And yet, every single time they showed the wind speeds along with the gusts, it wasn't even close to what the 140-mile-per-hour Category 4 description was. Now, I do understand that the worst winds are just around the eye of a hurricane, and that's where they measure the top speeds, because that is going to hit somewhere. But even where the eye went over, it was like somewhere near Perry, I think, Florida. I think that was the town. Like, the winds gusts were like 55 miles per hour, sustained at like 32 miles per hour. And everywhere around the eye, like, I never saw anything when they were putting up wind speeds. There was nothing approaching anything close to 140, or even 100 for that matter. Like, I'd like to know what, I'm curious as to what the maximum wind speed was in terms of what you recorded as. Are you there?
Yeah. I have, sorry, that was something playing on the YouTube. I have no idea. Again, I didn't watch it. My parents are in Florida right now, so I was like, as long as they're safe, I'm good. I don't need to jazz myself up with any of that stuff.
I'm not trying to diminish the significance of this storm, because the storm surge and the flooding and the rains is really looks like it was more of, and often it is, the hurricanes really are about the storm surge. That's what takes the most lives. That's what creates the most damage. But it's like, I just didn't see when the Weather Channel was posting all of the wind speeds on in all of their various locations. I just never saw anything after the eye crossed, into Florida. I never saw anything approaching even close to what the category of hurricane speed was, or even, you know, two-thirds of that. Maybe I just missed it. We're certainly hoping for the best. So you're saying, let's go back to why you brought this up. Sorry for that. There could be some games that get canceled or moved.
Yeah. So like Liberty Appalachian said canceled. You know, I think the negative thing was some of the way that, because I think by the time NFL
games. That's important
games,
to Denton, by the way, because that is he important went to me. Jerry Falwell University.
Well, I went to Liberty. We can take Jerry Falwell's name off that. But, like, I don't think for NFL games it'll be a problem, just because you'll have, you know, 2-3 days in some instances to kind of let some of that subside.
Yeah.
But yeah, that game was scheduled for noon tomorrow. So as I look at, like, the schedule, you get Duke in North Carolina, but that's a 4 p.m. game, so they might have time to make sure that it's safe to get to. Clemson is playing it at 7, so they might have time to make sure it's safe to get to.
Georgia-Bama's okay.
Georgia-Bama should be okay. Yeah, I mean, it might be a rainy game, so that might impact the way that you gamble it. I mean, but actually, the number in terms of total has gone up. It's now 50.5.
I'm wondering just about some of the Midwest, like even South Bend. I mean, there's a big game there. I think the rains are going to be up there at that time. What's the South Bend weather supposed to be?
Well, Notre Dame, that line has moved. Notre Dame was 6.5. Now they're at 7.
Yeah, rain tomorrow. It doesn't look like, you know, soaking rains. All right. You know what? Injuries and weather. Always things you should check before you fire in on a football game. They're important. Anything else?
That's all I got for you.
All right, when we come back, I will give you keys to a Washington win Sunday in Arizona. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, the team980.com. We're free and live on the Odyssey app. Washington and Arizona. Washington beats Arizona if my keys to winning Sunday in the desert. First of all, I think they definitely can win. Let me start with this before I get to a couple of these specific keys. Now that we've seen three games from all 32 teams in the NFL, actually we've seen four from two of the teams last night, there's never total clarity on what these teams will be after three games. But we have more clarity 3 weeks into the season than we did 3 weeks ago. And some of these things may hold up. And I would guess that while both teams, the Commanders and Cardinals, will have ups and downs coming on both sides of the ball in coming weeks, one thing appears to be true at this point and looks to be something that will hold up more than anything else. And that is, both teams are much better on offense than they are on defense. This game's got shootout written all over it. Washington leads the league in fewest punts with 3 total in 3 games. Arizona's tied for 7th with the fewest punts with just 8 in 3 games. Arizona's the 4th highest scoring team in the league. Washington is 5th. Arizona's got the number 7 offense per the DVOA metric. Washington has the number 9 offense per DVOA. Arizona's defense is 23rd per DVOA. Washington's is not only dead last at 32nd, it's dead last by 13 percentage points, which is a statistical massive difference. What it means is essentially they could have a lights out performance defensively for the next 2 games and still be dead last in the NFL per that metric. All right, number one, and this isn't that hard this week because of what we've seen the last 2 weeks. Offensively, they've got to do what they've been doing. I'll get into specifically what that means here in a moment, but it's unrealistic to believe that they're not going to punt again for 3 straight games, but you can't punt that much. You know, one punt in either of their last 2 games would have cost them both of those games. One punt against the Giants, they lose. One punt against Cincinnati, they lose. And it may be the case that one punt on Sunday costs them a football game. But it's unrealistic to imagine that they won't punt for 3 straight games. But you can't punt much, like once, twice, max. And then you cannot turn the ball over. It's more than cliche now. With this football team, if you don't end up with at least the same number of possessions and the same kind of field position that your opponent has, you're going to lose because you can't stop the other team. Now, specifically on offense, they can run the football against this team. In watching the Detroit game in particular last week, because their week 2 win against the Rams, I'm not going to say that it's fake because they were awesome in that game, but the Rams were decimated with injuries in that game. They jumped out to a 21-0 lead early in the second quarter, and it wasn't a game after that. Last week, the Lions game was a really interesting game. Now, Detroit ran the ball at will, and they ran it right up the gut. They ran it between the tackles. And they ran it between the tackles because Arizona's 3-4 up front is not very good. David Montgomery, 105 yards, 4.6 yards per carry. Jahmyr Gibbs, 83 yards, 5.2 yards per carry. Those two guys combined for 188 yards and over 5 yards per pop. So you have to run the football. Now, we thought that that was a bit of the of a key against a vulnerable Cincinnati front as well. And Cincinnati loaded the box. And they did a good job by really stopping Brian Robinson Jr., which was clearly the plan. I don't know if Arizona loads the box, it's going to make that much difference. By the way, keep an eye on their injury report. Buda Baker, we'll get an update on him with Ben here in a few minutes. But you should be able to run the football. And by the way, you should be able to throw the football too. Jared Goff was 18 of 23. Play action off their ability to run the football was outstanding. And keep in mind, you know, Arizona in their first three games, or their last two games, has not played a mobile quarterback, Stafford and Goff. Washington, from an ability to, with a dual threat, 11-on-11 run game attack, I think can run the football. I think we could see something more like what we saw in week two against the Giants. And even though I think there will be less, you know, sort of zone read keepers, even though I thought Jaden actually last week should have pulled it a few more times, but typically, again, against 3-4s, gut than pulling it in the zone read. I think it's a huge day for Brian Robinson Jr. I think they're going to miss Eckler a lot, and we'll see what happens behind Brian Robinson Jr. But run the football against Arizona. They can be run on between the tackles. That's, to me, the key number one offensively, doing what you've done the last 2 weeks. And I think it happens more with rushing yards against Arizona than it does with passing yards. Now, again, if Arizona loads up the box and they're loaded up with 7 or 8, they're going to check to throws, and Jaden's been really good at diagnosing defenses and getting them in to the right plays. Key number two, and I just don't see how they're going to be able to do this, but you've got, now, Detroit's much better defensively, and they forced Arizona into 1-for-9 on third down. Arizona went for a bunch of fourth downs, but Arizona punted the game five times. But it really was a little bit flukish. Arizona's fifth in the league in drop passes. They had last week a couple of crucial penalties against that derailed drives. They missed on a fourth down. I just don't know how they're going to contain Kyler Murray outside the pocket. And the fact that they don't generate much pass rush, the fact that they can't cover. And Trey McBride's out, it looks like. That'll be a huge key if he is out. But still, you know, whether it's Harrison Jr., whether it's Wilson, whether it's Dortch, whether it's Higgins, who would step up if McBride is out, I don't know how they can cover if he gets outside the pocket, which he does on a regular basis. And so the key to a better defensive effort is they've got to be able to contain Kyler Murray in the pocket. You have to force him to be a pocket passer. That's hard when you try to say, hey, we're going to play contain rush versus rush, and you haven't done either one very well in the first 2 weeks. By the way, don't underestimate what their ability to run the football, as teams have against Washington, especially the last two games, Singletary and then Chase Brown and Zach Moss last week. James Conner had 122 against the Rams. He's a good back. Got less opportunities against the Lions, in part because they went down 2 scores in the second quarter trying to play catch-up. But offensively, super important to keep up this pace of, you know, essentially no free possessions for the other team, punting as little as possible. I think they can run the football and be effective Sunday against that 3-4, especially up front. And then defensively, you've got to keep Kyler Murray in the pocket as a passer, where he is less effective than he is outside the pocket. Kyler Murray has been making those plays that you're used to Kyler Murray making, where he gets, you know, he breaks contain, the play gets extended, he goes one way, he circles back the other way, and then somebody like Marvin Harrison Jr. is wide open because you can't cover that long. You got to stop the run, too, defensively. They have not been able to do that. I don't know. I would imagine Arizona sees an opportunity for James Conner to have a big game. Here's something else in this game. Washington has decided here recently to kick and play coverage on kickoffs. It's actually a bit of an underrated spot for them. They've been good on returns. They're way up there on kickoff returns with the Eckler 62-yarder. But what's interesting is in terms of kickoff returns, Arizona's number one at averaging 41 yards per kickoff return. Washington's number three at 34 yards per kickoff return. The issue has been two big returns. They've had the two of the biggest three returns of the year. DJ Dallas returned one for a touchdown in week one, and Eckler had the 62-yarder. There's only been one other big return, and Chicago had that as a 67-yarder. I don't know if you saw this stat last night, but the kickoff return percentage for the season, or I'm sorry, the touchback percentage, is the second lowest, or the second highest ever. Last year was the highest touchback percentage of all time, and this year through 3 weeks is the second highest percentage of touchbacks of all time. So teams are still regularly deciding to kick it through the end zone and give the team the ball at the 30-yard line. But special teams will be big tomorrow. Return game could be huge. I'd like to see Washington tomorrow maybe not take as many chances kicking to DJ Dallas. They may feel differently than they would have had Austin Eckler been in the game. And honestly, I don't know who will replace Eckler. Those are, to me, the three keys. Run the football, don't give it up. Keep Kyler Murray contained and try to get off the field. And then, you know, and then thirdly, be careful special teams-wise, win that starting field position battle. And then I think lastly, it'll come down to defensively tackling well. Arizona's very good yards after contact with receivers, tight ends, and running backs. You've got to tackle well, and you probably need a couple of breaks, like a punch out, the one St. Juice had against the Giants. That's not a break, that's a force, but maybe a couple of penalties that Arizona can't overcome early in drives. I like their chances, though, Sunday. We'll have predictions in the next hour. Ben Standing next.